Thank you very much. You can hear me? Yes. I've been at this now 23 years. We've worked with my colleagues and I, we've worked in about 30 countries. We've advised 9 truth commissions, official truth commissions, 4 UN missions, 4 international criminal tribunals. We've testified in 4 different cases, 2 internationally, 2 domestically, and we've advised dozens and dozens of non-governmental human rights groups around the world. The point of this stuff is to figure out how to bring the knowledge of the people who've suffered human rights violations to bear on demanding accountability from the perpetrators. Our job is to figure out how we can tell the truth. It is one of the moral foundations of the international human rights movement that we speak truth to power. We look in the face of the powerful and we tell them what we believe they have done that is wrong. If that's going to work, we have to speak the truth. We have to be right. We have to get the analysis on. That's not always easy. And to get there, there are sort of 3 themes that I want to try to touch in this talk. Since the talk's pretty short, I'm really going to touch on 2 of them. So at the very end of the talk, I'll invite people who'd like to talk more about the specifically technical aspects of this work, about classifiers, about clustering, about statistical estimation, about database techniques. If people want to talk about that, I'd love to gather, and we'll try to find a space. I've been fighting with the wiki for 2 days. I think I'm probably not the only one. We can gather, and we can talk about that stuff more in detail. So today, in the next 25 minutes, I'm going to focus specifically on the trial of General José Efraín Ríos Montt, who ruled Guatemala from March 1982 until August 1983. That's General Ríos there in the upper corner in the red tie. During the government of General Ríos Montt, tens of thousands of people were killed by the army of Guatemala. And the question that has been facing Guatemalans since that time is, did the pattern of killing that the army committed constitute acts of genocide? Now, genocide is a very specific crime in international law. It does not mean you killed a lot of people. There are other war crimes for mass killing. Genocide specifically means that you picked out a particular group, and to the exclusion of other groups nearby them, you focused on eliminating that group. That's key, because for a statistician, that gives us a hypothesis we can test, which is, what is the relative risk? What is the differential probability of people in the target group being killed relative to their neighbors who were not in the target group? So, without further ado, let's look at the relative risk of being killed for indigenous people in the 3 rural counties of Chajul, Quetzal, and Nebach relative to their non-indigenous neighbors. We have, and I'll talk in a moment about how we have this, we have information and evidence and estimations of the deaths of about 2,150 indigenous people, people killed by the army in the period of the government of General Ríos. The population, the total number of people alive who were indigenous in those counties in the census of 1981 is about 39,000. So the approximate crude mortality rate due to homicide by the army is 5.5% for indigenous people in that period. Now, that's relative to the homicide rate for non-indigenous people in the same place of approximately 0.7%. So what we ask is, what is the ratio between those 2 numbers? And the ratio between those 2 numbers is the relative risk. It's approximately 8. We interpret that as, if you were an indigenous person alive in one of those 3 counties in 1982, your probability of being killed by the army was 8 times greater than a person also living in those 3 counties who was not indigenous. 8 times. 8 times. To put that in relative terms, the relative risk of being a Bosniak relative to being Serb in Bosnia during the war in Bosnia was a little less than 3. So your relative risk of being indigenous was more than twice, nearly 3 times as much as your relative risk of being Bosniak in the Bosnian War. That's an astonishing level of focus. It shows tremendous planning and coherence, I believe. So, again, coming back to the statistical conclusion, how do we come to that? How do we find that information? How do we make that conclusion? First, we're only looking at homicides committed by the army. We're not looking at homicides committed by other parties, by the guerrillas, by private actors. We're not looking at excess mortality, the mortality that we might find in conflict that is in excess of normal peacetime mortality. We're not looking at any of that, only homicide. And the percentage relates the number of people killed by the army with the population that was alive. That's crucial here. We're looking at rates. And we're comparing the rate of the indigenous people shown in the blue bar to non-indigenous people shown in the green bar. The width of the bars show the relative populations in each of those two communities. So clearly there are many more indigenous people, but a higher fraction of them are also killed. The bars also show something else, and that's what I'll focus on for the rest of the talk. There are two sections to each of the two bars, a dark section on the bottom, a lighter section on top. And what that indicates is what we know in terms of being able to name people with their first and last name, their location and dates of death, and what we must infer statistically. Now I'm beginning to touch on the second theme of my talk, which is that when we are studying mass violence and war crimes, we cannot do statistical or pattern analysis with raw information. We must use the tools of mathematical statistics to understand what we don't know, the information which cannot be observed directly. We have to estimate that in order to control for the process of the production of information. Information doesn't just fall out of the sky the way it does for industry. If I'm running an ISP, I know every packet that runs through my routers. That's not how the social world works. In order to find information about killings, we have to hear about that killing from someone. We have to investigate. We have to find the human remains. And if we can't observe the killing, we won't hear about it. And many killings are hidden. In my team, we have a kind of catchphrase that the world, if a lawyer is killed in a big city at high noon, the world knows about it before dinner time, every single time. But when a rural peasant is killed 3 days' walk from a road in the dead of night, we're unlikely to ever hear. And technology is not changing this. I'll talk later about that. Technology is actually making the problem worse. So let's get back to Guatemala. And just conclude that the little vertical bars, little vertical lines at the top of each bar indicate the confidence interval, which is similar to what lay people sometimes call a margin of error. It is our level of uncertainty about each of those estimates. And you'll notice that the uncertainty is much, much smaller than the difference between the two bars. The uncertainty does not affect our ability to draw the conclusion that there was a spectacular difference in the mortality rates between the people who were the hypothesized target of genocide and those who were not. Now, the data. First, we had the census of 1981. This was a crucial piece. I think there's very interesting questions to ask about why the government of Guatemala conducted a census on the eve of committing a genocide. There is excellent work done by historical demographers about the use of censuses in mass violence. It has been common throughout history. Similarly, there were four very large projects. First, the CIIDH, a group of non-governmental human rights groups, collected 1,240 records of deaths in this three-county region. Next, the Catholic Church collected a bit fewer than 800 deaths. The Truth Commission, the Comisión de Esclarecimiento Histórico, conducted a really big research project in the late 1990s, and of that we got information about a little bit more than 1,000 deaths. And then the National Program for Compensation is very, very large and gave us about 4,700 records of deaths. Now, this is interesting. But this is not unique. Many of the deaths are reported in common across those data sources. And so we think about this in terms of a Venn diagram. We think of how do these different data sets intersect with each other or collide with each other. And we can diagram that as in the sense of these three white circles intersecting. But as I mentioned earlier, we're also interested in what we have not observed. And this is crucial for us because when we're thinking about how much information we have to distinguish between the world on the left, in which our intersecting circles cover about a third of the reality, versus the world on the right, where our intersecting circles cover all of reality. These are very different worlds. And the reason they're so different is not simply because we want to know the magnitude, not simply because we want to know the total number of killings. That's important. But even more important, we have to know that we've estimated in equal proportions the two parties. We have to estimate in equal proportions the number of deaths of non-Indigenous people and the number of deaths of Indigenous people. Because if we don't get those estimates correct, our comparison of their mortality rates will be biased. Our story will be wrong. We will fail to speak truth to power. Can't have that. So what do? Algebra. Algebra is our friend. So I'm going to give you just a tiny taste of how we solve this problem. And I'm going to introduce a series of assumptions. Those of you who'd like to debate those assumptions, I invite you to join me after the talk, and we will talk endlessly and tediously about capture heterogeneity. But in the short term, we have a universe N of total killings in a specific time, space, ethnicity, location. And of that, we have two projects, A and B. A captures some number of deaths from the universe N. And the probability with which a death is captured by Project A from the universe N is, by elementary probability theory, the number of deaths documented by A divided by the unknown number of deaths in the population N. Similarly, the probability with which a death from N is documented by Project B, B over N, and this is the cool part. The probability with which a death is documented by both A and B is M. Now, we can put the two databases together, we can compare them. Let's talk about the use of random forest classifiers and clustering to do that later. But we can put the two databases together, compare them, determine the deaths that are in M, that is in M, both A and B, and divide M by N. But also by probability theory, the probability that a death occurs in M is equal to the product of the individual probabilities. Okay? The probability of any compound event, an event made up of two independent events, is equal to the product of those two events. So M over N is equal to A over N times B over N. Solve for N. Okay? Multiply through by N squared, divide by M, and we have an estimate of N which is equal to AB over M. Now, the light's in my eyes, I can't see, but I saw a few light bulbs go off over people's heads. And when I showed this proof to the judge in the trial of General Rios, I saw a light bulb go on over her head. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. So we don't do it in two systems because that takes a lot of assumptions. We do it in four. You'll recall that we have four data sources. We organize the data sources in this format such that we have an inclusion and exclusion pattern in the table on the left, which for which we can define the number of deaths which fall into each of these intersecting patterns. And I'll give you a very quick metaphor here. And the metaphor is, imagine that you have two dark rooms and you want to assess the size of those two rooms. Which room is larger? And the only tool that you have to assess the size of those rooms is a handful of little rubber balls. The little rubber balls have a property that when they hit each other, they make a sound. So we throw the balls into the first room and we listen and we hear. We collect the balls, go to the second room, throw them with equal force, imagining a spherical cow of uniform density. We throw the balls into the second room with equal force and we hear. So which room is larger? The second room, because we hear fewer collisions, right? Well, the estimation, the toy example I gave in the previous slide, is the mathematical formalization of the intuition that fewer collisions mean a larger space. And so what we're doing here is laying out the pattern of collisions, not just the collisions, the pairwise collisions, but the three-way and four-way collisions. And that allows us to make the estimate that was shown in the bar graph of the light part of each of the bars. So we can come back to our conclusion and put a confidence interval on the estimates. And the confidence intervals are shown there. Now I'm going to move through this somewhat more quickly to get to the end of the talk. But I want to put up one more slide that was used in the testimony. And that is that we divided time into 16-month periods and compared the 16-month period of General Rios's governance. Now, it's only 16 months because we went April to July because there's only a few days in August and a few days in March, so we shaved those off. Okay, 16-month period of General Rios's government and compared it to several periods before and after. And I think that the key observation here is that the rate of killing against indigenous people is substantially higher done under General Rios' government than under previous or succeeding governments. But more importantly, the ratio between the two, the relative risk of being killed as an indigenous person was at its peak during the government of General Rios. Have we proven genocide? No. This is evidence consistent with the hypothesis that acts of genocide were committed. The finding of genocide is a legal finding, not so much a scientific one. So as scientists, our job is to provide evidence that the finders of fact, the judges in this case, can use in their determination. This is evidence consistent with that hypothesis. Were this evidence otherwise, as scientists, we would say we would reject the hypothesis that genocide was committed. However, with this evidence, we find that the evidence, the data, is consistent with the prosecution's hypothesis. So, it worked. Rios Montt was convicted on genocide charges. Okay. For a week. Then the Constitutional Court intervened. I know a couple of experts on Guatemala here in the audience who can tell you more about why that happened and exactly what happened. However, the Constitutional Court ordered a new trial, which is at this time scheduled for the very beginning of 2015. And I look forward to testifying again, and again, and again, and again. Look, but I want to come back to this point because as a bunch of technologists, there's a lot of folks who really like technology here. I really like it too. Technology doesn't get us to science. You have to have science to get you to science. Technology helps you organize the data. It helps you do all kinds of extremely great and cool things without which we wouldn't be able to even do the science. But you can't have just technology. You can't just have a bunch of data and make conclusions. That's naive and you will get the wrong conclusions. The point of rigorous statistics is to be right, and there's a little bit of a caveat there, or to at least know how uncertain you are. Statistics is often called the science of uncertainty. That is actually my favorite definition of it. So I'm going to assume that we care about getting it right. No one laughed. That's good. Not everyone does, to my distress. So if you only have some of the data, and I will argue that we always only have some of the data, you need some kind of model that will tell you the relationship between your data and the real world. Okay? Statisticians call that an inference. In order to get from here to there, you're going to need some kind of probability model that tells you why your data is like the world, or in what sense you have to tweak, twiddle, and do algebra with your data to get from what you can observe to what is actually true. And statistics is about comparisons. Yeah, we get a big number, and journalists love the big number, but it's really about these relationships and patterns. So to get those relationships and patterns, in order for them to be right, in order for our answer to be correct, every one of the estimates we make for every point in the pattern has to be right. It's a hard problem. It's a hard problem. And what I worry about is that we've come into this world in which people throw the notion of big data around as though the data allows us to make an end run around problems of sampling and modeling. It doesn't. So as technologists, the reason I'm, you know, ranting at you guys about it is that it's very tempting to have a lot of data and think you have an answer. And it's even more tempting because in industry context, you might be right. Not so much in human rights. Not so much. Violence is a hidden process. The people who commit violence have an enormous commitment to hiding it, distorting it, explaining it in different ways. All of those things dramatically affect the information that is produced from the violence that we're going to use to do our analysis. So we usually don't know what we don't know in human rights data collection. And that means that we don't know if what we don't know is systematically different from what we do know. Maybe we know about all the lawyers and we don't know about the people in the countryside. Maybe we know about all the indigenous people and not the non-indigenous people. If that were true, the argument that I just made would be merely an artifact of the reporting process rather than some true analysis. Now, we did the estimation, so I believe we can reject that critique, but that's what we have to worry about. And let's go back to the Venn diagram and say, which of these is accurate? It's not just for one of the points in our pattern analysis. The problem is that we're going to compare things, as in Peru, where we compared killings committed by the Peruvian army against killings committed by the Maoist guerrillas with the Sendero Luminoso. And we found there that, in fact, we knew very little about what the Sendero Luminoso had done, whereas we knew almost everything of what the Peruvian army had done. This is called the coverage rate, the rate between what we know and what we don't know. And raw data, however big, does not get us to patterns. And here's a bunch of lists, here's a bunch of kinds of raw data that I've used and that I really enjoy using. You know, truth commission testimonies, UN investigations, press articles, SMS messages, crowdsourcing, NGO documentation, social media feeds, perpetrator records, government archives, state agency registries. I know those sound all the same, but they actually turn out to be slightly different. Happy to talk in tedious detail. Refugee camp records, any non-random sample. All of those are going to take some kind of probability model. And we don't have that many probability models to use. So raw data is great for cases, but it doesn't get you to patterns. And patterns, again, patterns are the thing that allow us to do analysis. They're the thing that the patterns are what get us to something that we can use to help prosecutors, advocates, and the victims themselves. I gave a version of this talk, a much earlier version of this talk, several years ago in Medellin, Colombia. I've worked a lot in Colombia. It's a great place to work. There's really terrific victims' rights groups there. And a woman from a township, like smaller than a county, near to Medellin, came up to me after the talk, and she said, you know, a lot of people, you know, I'm a human rights activist. My job is to collect data. I tell stories about people who suffer. But there are people in my village, I know, who've had people in their families disappeared, and they're never going to talk about it, ever. We're never going to be able to use their names because they're afraid. We can't name the victims. At least we'd better count them. So, about that counting, there's three ways to do it right. You can have a perfect census. You can have all the data. Yeah, it's nice. Good luck with that. You can have a random sample of the population. That's hard. Sometimes doable, but very hard. In my experience, we rarely interview victims of homicide. Very rarely. And that means there's a complicated probability relationship between the person you sampled to interview and the death that they talked to you about. Or you can do some kind of posterior modeling of the sampling process, which is in essence what I proposed in the earlier slide. So what can we do with raw data? Guys, we're going to collect a bunch of data. We can say that a case exists. Okay, that's actually important. We can say something happened with raw data. We can say we know something about that case. We can say there were 100 victims in that case, or at least 100 victims in that case, if we can name 100 people. But we can't do comparisons. This is the biggest massacre this year. Well, we don't really know, because we don't know about the massacres we don't know about. No patterns. Don't talk about the hotspot of violence. No, we don't know that. Happy to talk more about that if we gather after. But I want to come to a close here with the importance of getting it right. I've talked about one case today. This is another case, the case of this man, Edgar Fernando Garcia. Mr. Garcia was a student and labor leader in Guatemala early in the 1980s. He left his office in February 1984, did not come home. People reported later that they saw someone shoving Mr. Garcia into a vehicle and driving away. His widow became a very important human rights activist in Guatemala. Now she's a very important and, in my opinion, impressive politician. And there's her infant daughter. She continued to struggle to find out what had happened to Mr. Garcia for decades. And in 2006, documents came to light in the National Archives of the Historical Archives of the National Police, showing that the police had realized an operation in the area of Mr. Garcia's office, and it was very likely that they had disappeared him. These two guys up here in the upper right were police officers in that area. They were arrested, charged with the disappearance of Mr. Garcia, and convicted. Part of the evidence used to convict them was communications metadata showing that documents flowed through the archive. I mean, paper communications. We coded it by hand. We went through and read the from and to lines from every memo. And they were convicted in 2010. And after that conviction, Mr. Garcia's infant daughter, now a grown woman, is clearly joyful. Justice brings closure to a family that never knows when to start talking about someone in the past tense. Perhaps even more powerfully, those guys' grand boss, their boss's boss, Colonel Hector Bol de la Cruz, this man here, was convicted of Mr. Garcia's disappearance in September this year. I don't know if any of you have ever been dissident students, but if you've been dissident students demonstrating in the street, think about how you would feel if your friends and comrades were disappeared, and take a long look at Colonel Bol de la Cruz. Here's the rest of the stuff that we'll talk about if we gather afterwards. Thank you very much for your attention. I really have enjoyed CCC.